All right, good morning. Hey, if you want to grab a Bible and turn to Revelation chapter 3, we're going to look at verses 7 through 13. Just a moment here. Revelation chapter 3. Starting in verse 7 of chapter 3 and then going through verse 13. Let's read together. Write to the angel of the church in Philadelphia. Thus says the Holy One, the true one, the one who has the key of David, who opens and no one will close, and who closes and no one opens. I know your works. Look, I have placed before you an open door that no one can close because you have but little power. Yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Note this, I will make those from the synagogue of Satan who claim to be Jews and are not, but are lying, I will make them come and bow down at your feet, and they will know that I have loved you, because you have kept my command to endure. I will also keep you from the hour of testing that is coming, that is going to come on the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one takes your crown. The one who conquers, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will never go out again. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. Let anyone who has ears to hear listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. And this is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God. Okay, so we are on the sixth of seven letters from Jesus. Now you'll notice we're in Philadelphia. Here's the city of brotherly love. That's how we think about it, at least. But in the ancient city of Philadelphia, there was no love for one group of people. Can you guess who that was? It's the followers of Jesus who were there. You may think it was the pagan Gentiles in the city that were persecuting the church. After all, you could go there and you'd find temples and all kinds of things that were kind of erected to these various gods and the Caesars. Maybe it was these kind of pagans that put pressure on the Christians. But friends, it wasn't the pagans. It was the Jews. You see, the Jews in Philadelphia despised the Christian religion that claimed that Jesus was God and that Jesus was this long-awaited Messiah. This is blasphemous to them. Judaism was a state-recognized and thus a state-protected religion. Rome had their back such that they were exempt from participating in pagan worship. But Christianity was not an officially recognized religion. It was a group of religious rabble-rousers and radicals. So when they refused to participate in pagan worship, they were persecuted. Sometimes to avoid persecution, Jewish Christians continued to attend the local Jewish synagogue. And so the Jews in Philadelphia, at some point, they took steps to close the synagogue door to these Jewish Christians, to shut them out. I want you to imagine with me how this would have impacted this little church. And really, we don't have to imagine because Jesus tells us in these verses. He says, "You have but little power." You see that in the opening verses? Here's a church that is weak. Here's a church that is small in the eyes of its city. Here's a church that is struggling. They were feeling unsettled in their home city of Philadelphia. The New Testament makes sense of this when it says that Christians are exiles or sojourners or aliens. Many of these Philadelphian Christians grew up in this city. It's all they knew. But friends, after they became Christians, everything changed for them. Now they felt more like an outsider in their own city. Everything they believed, everything they did for Jesus came under scrutiny. They felt dislodged in their own city. They felt powerless in their own city. They felt discouraged by their own city. And I just wonder, Christian, is this how you feel sometimes in the 21st century here in Cincinnati? Now, how does Jesus respond to them? Notice there is no rebuke here. There's only encouragement. In fact, notice twice he says in verse 8 and verse 10, you have kept my word, or you have kept my commandments. So this is a good church. He's telling them, hey, great job, Philly church. You've persevered even in the face of persecution. Yes, you are weak, but I will make you strong. In fact, his commendation here is 3.5 verses long, longer than any other commendation given to the other six churches. It shows us just how pleased Jesus is with this church. In fact, he's so pleased with this church that he keeps interrupting his commendation of what they are doing well in order to tell them what he is doing for them. This happens 3 times. He's so concerned with the struggling church. He so loves the struggling church that even as he commends them, he just kind of bubbles over with more of himself. He knows that what they need is a clearer vision of himself, who he is right now for them. I wonder, church family, how you're doing right now. I wonder what you need. I wonder the kinds of burdens that perhaps you have as you walked into this place. Isn't this what we need as well? A clear vision of Jesus, who he is right now for you and for me. Here's the main point of the passage in a sentence. Very simple. Jesus keeps forever those who keep his word now. Jesus keeps forever those who keep his word now. Now, why is that statement true? Why is it true? It's a very strong statement. It's a very strong promise. It's a very kind of lavish privilege that Christians have. I mean, why is that true? Well, that's what we're going to see as we walk through our passage. I want to give you 4 reasons to be confident in Jesus. I want to encourage you this morning, especially if you are weak, you're struggling, this passage is for you. So listen to the voice of the Lord. 4 reasons to be confident in Jesus. Here's the first reason. Jesus welcomes us. So you look at verses 7 and 8. Jesus welcomes us. Notice how he presents himself to this bedraggled church, and he offers up 3 titles. The first 2 are the Holy One. That's a title for Yahweh or a title for God. And then he says the True One. So he is trustworthy. The things that he said about himself, specifically that he's the Messiah, they're true. We got to understand this because the Jews vehemently denied that Jesus is God. They saw Jesus as this kind of pretend Messiah, this wannabe Messiah. We got to put ourselves in the Philippian church's shoes. Now, imagine kind of huddling together secretly in some home in Philadelphia, and after one of your Christian friends is kind of dragged into prison because he's confessed Jesus really is God, that Jesus really is this Messiah. And as you kind of sit fearful in that little home on a Sunday morning, someone turns to you and says, hey, we've got a sermon here from the Apostle John, who's in this island of Patmos. Someone should read it to us. And you come to realize as you listen to the first 2 chapters that Jesus is speaking very directly and powerfully to these 7 churches in Asia Minor. And then you come to this part of the letter, and it's for you. It's for your brothers and sisters. Jesus has a word specifically for you. And he starts with, notice, hey, you're right. I am God. I am the Messiah. I am trustworthy. How unbelievably comforting to hear these words at the beginning of this sermon. The 3rd title, notice it's a little longer, says the one who has the key of David, who opens and no one will close, and who closes and no one will open. Now, this is closely echoed in the words of Isaiah 22, which is actually a messianic prophecy. Isaiah tells a man named Eliakim that he would be given the key to the royal household of David. Like him is a type of Christ. And so like Eliakim, Jesus would have absolute power over the Davidic throne as the Davidic king. Eliakim would rule over, yes, Jerusalem and Judah and the house of David. Jesus, as you know, his sovereignty extends over all nations and all peoples. So that's kind of the backdrop here. Eliakim is a type of Christ, and the language here is used in this title. Now, how does it relate to this passage? Well, Jesus, notice, holds the keys of David. And that means that he and he alone has the authority to admit people into God's kingdom or to exclude people from God's kingdom. And this is in sharp contrast to the Jews in Philadelphia who claimed they had the authority to admit or to exclude. Remember, they took steps to close the door on these Christians, to excommunicate them from the synagogue's membership, to kind of persecute them in this way. And then as we get into verse 8, I want you to notice, we see even more of how this applies to this church. Jesus says, I know your works. Look, I have placed before you an open door that no one can close because you have but little power. Yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Now, in the book of Revelation, the open door metaphor refers to entrance into this heavenly temple. We see this especially in chapter 4. And so for decades, the very people who these Christians were close to, the Jews, now they rejected them. They maligned them. They slandered them. They scandalized them. This is why Jesus says, you have little power. In the city's eyes, this church has no power. They're weak. They're small. They're obscure. They're insignificant. But friends, I want you to notice this. Who are they in Jesus' eyes? Who are they in his eyes? Because they keep his word. Jesus says to them, hey, you're poor in spirit. That's okay because yours is the kingdom of heaven. You might have just got kicked out of the synagogue, but you can't get kicked out of my temple kingdom. What I open, no one can shut. No Roman authority can shut it. No Jewish synagogue can shut. Friends, you and I may lose our place in this world. We may lose our place in the workplace. We may lose our place in our social circles or among our neighbors or among certain theological tribes or even among our families. But we can never lose our place with Jesus. If you're a Christian, Jesus will always welcome you in. You always have a place with Jesus at his table. So who is Jesus for you right now? Who is Jesus for Faith Church? Who is Jesus for the weak and the vulnerable and the outsider? He is the one who has the key of David, the welcomer of justified sinners. You will always have a home with Jesus. What an incredible gift that today and every day this week you can commune with your God through Jesus, that you can fellowship with God because of Jesus. He's welcomed you into his presence. You need not fear, for the blood of Christ has made a way. The price has been paid so that we can draw boldly to God. Now, of course, the question is, do we enjoy this gift? Do you and I, do we enjoy this gift? You know, John Owen once said, listen carefully, unacquaintedness with our mercies and privileges is our sin as well as our trouble. It makes us go heavily when we might rejoice. It makes us feel weak where we might be strong in the Lord. Friends, too often we are like a toddler who's been given this incredible gift but then chooses to play with a wrapping paper. I know you've seen this. I mean, I've seen this for years, you know? The problem is he doesn't understand the value of the gift, right? He's unacquainted with the magnitude of the gift. What do you do with a toddler who plays with the ribbon instead of the toy? You draw his attention to the gift. And friends, that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. This weak and struggling church who has gotten kicked out. As they struggle onwards, as we struggle onwards, we need to recognize the value of our gift. We've been given a gift of surpassing value. Surpasses all other gifts. The gift of divine welcome. Come on in. So who cares if someone takes away the box or takes away the ribbon, right? We've got the greatest gift, and no one can take it away from us. No one. Here's the second reason to be confident in Jesus. He vindicates us. Look at verse 9. Note this. I will make those from the synagogue of Satan who claim to be Jews and are not, but are lying, I will make them come and bow down at your feet, and they will know that I have loved you. On the basis of many Old Testament texts, there was an expectation that the Gentiles would one day fall down in submission to the Jews. So texts like Psalm 86, verse 9, and Isaiah 2, verse 3, and Ezekiel 36, verse 23. You can look them up later. So here what Jesus does is you can see he flips the script. He turns the expectation on its head. It's now the local Jewish persecutors who will be forced to fall down in humiliation and submission before the Christians. In fact, one day at the end of the age, Jesus promises to publicly vindicate them. Look at the end of verse 9. They will know that I have loved you. What an astonishing statement. The Jews in Philadelphia claimed that they held the key into the entrance of God's temple. They were trusting in their own ability to keep the law. But we know that we are not justified by the works of the law. It's not our work that makes us right with God. It's Christ's work on the cross. The Jews had the wrong key. You know, it doesn't work in the keyhole. They're trying to get it in there and trying to open the door. It doesn't work, but they thought it worked. And as a result, they came after these Christians. They made their life difficult. But notice Jesus says to them, one day they will submit to you. One day you will participate in the judgment of God's enemies. One day they will know that I have put my love not on them, but on you. Friends, today is the day of public scrutiny and suspicion for God's church, but a day is coming that will be the day of public exoneration. There's a little verse in Colossians that I think kind of lays on top of this very nicely. Colossians 3, you can turn there if you want. Colossians 3, verses 3 and 4. And I just want you to hear this. This is really, really interesting, and it really maps on to what Jesus is saying here. Paul says to the Colossian church, your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. This little verse invites us to think carefully about our present situation and our future situation. Presently, hear me now, our lives as Christians are hidden with Christ. Right now, Jesus is the risen Lord. He's the reigning Lord, but he's also hidden from view. The world doesn't see his glory. The world doesn't acknowledge his authority or recognize his true identity or respect his words. And today, we are not only united to Christ in his death and resurrection. Right now, friends, we're united to him in his hiddenness. We're united to him in his obscurity. You ever thought about this? This is what Jesus is communicating to the Philadelphia church. Right now, you may be weak and powerless and obscure. What is true of you is hidden. What is false about you is public. But yet you are co-heirs with me. You will one day rule this universe with me, and your enemies will even bow before you. But right now, no one can know this about you by looking at you, right? This is so instructive for us today. Listen, friends. Our friends, our neighbors, even family, not all of them see who we really are. No one comes up to us and says, oh yeah, it's clear that God has chosen you and loves you and is going to vindicate you someday. Like nobody actually does that, right? Nobody sees that in us. No one sees that. What do they see? They see our bedhead in the mornings as we roll out the trash, and they smell our coffee breath, and they wonder why we're so goofy, and they see our frailty and weakness and limitations. This is the lot of the Christian in this life. It's to be despised. It's to be laughed at or misunderstood or misrepresented by the world, sometimes ridiculed for believing in things that cannot be seen. We're taking a pass on the rewards that can be seen, and we're waiting for a supposed treasure that will come someday, but no one's ever seen it. Have you ever thought about wanting to be a Christian in a different generation? You know, maybe the generation when Christianity was born, like the first century, you know, you get to hang out with Jesus in those first years, right? This incredible miracle worker. You get to see him teach and see these kind of tangible manifestations of the kingdom. It must have been amazing. But for whatever reason, this is not the lot that God has chosen for these Philadelphia Christians. 60 years after Jesus came and went, this isn't our lot either. He chose you and me to be someone who's united with him in his obscurity and hiddenness. The reality is we are much like David's faithful band of men in the desert. Remember this? 1 Samuel 22, you probably don't. That's okay. David is God's anointed king, but Saul's kind of ruling on a hill, but he's God's anointed king. But he's living in this cave with some of his men. It's kind of like us, followers of the true king, even though the pomp and glory lie somewhere else. So friends, don't be surprised that your friends and neighbors and coworkers are not impressed with your faith. Learn to accept your hiddenness. Embrace your mere life. Embrace the ordinary life. Embrace the hidden life. And this has corporate dimensions too. Are you okay, friends, if Faith Church is just a mere church? Just an ordinary church, an unimpressive entity, at least in the eyes of the world. Is that okay with you? Are you okay with our life together being somewhat hidden and obscure and strange to so many onlookers? Nothing flashy, but apparently utterly pleasing to Jesus. We can embrace our hiddenness because we know this life in the cave won't last forever. A day is coming when Jesus will publicly pull the curtain back on this universe. One day, what is true of us spiritually, what is hidden, will be made public. They will know that I have loved you. What an incredible comfort to us. Here's the third reason we should be confident in Jesus. Look at verse 10. Because you have kept my command to endure, I will also keep you from the hour of testing that is going to come on the whole world to test those who live on the earth. Now, what is Jesus saying here? Well, he's saying that the persecution that these Philadelphia Christians are facing is just a small and local foretaste of a larger and global type of persecution yet to come. In fact, the use of the Greek definite article, the hour, suggests this is a specific and well-known events. The phrase, those who live on the earth, is a technical expression in the book of Revelation. It's used actually 10 times, and it always refers to unbelievers who worship the beast and persecute Christ's church. So this event is none other than the Great Tribulation, the final outpouring of the judgment, of God's judgment on the world, just before Jesus comes back. But our question, I'm sure it's your question, what precisely is Jesus promising here to Christians? Is he promising escape from the Great Tribulation or safety through the Great Tribulation? Will Jesus remove his church physically? Will he rapture his church before the Great Tribulation? Or will he protect them through the Great Tribulation? Well, I would say Jesus means the latter. Jesus is promising the Christians at Philadelphia that he will keep them safe through this hour of testing. Let me give you a couple of reasons why. The first reason is kind of a nerdy grammatical lexical reason. Don't fall asleep. Okay, hear me now. If you're taking notes, maybe take this down. The only occurrence in the New Testament of the verb keep with the preposition from occurs in John 17, verse 15, where Jesus prays to his Father. Listen carefully. Jesus says, I ask not that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. You hear that? That you keep them from the evil one. Now, clearly, Jesus is not envisioning removing Christians from the evil one in this world or removing the evil one from the Christians in this world. The devil, according to Paul, still prowls around like a lion, ready to devour Christians. So Jesus is using the same language, keep and from, to promise protection through the Great Tribulation. Now, here's the second reason. It's the reason of context. The book of Revelation consistently depicts Christians not as escaping persecution, trouble, and martyrdom, but going through these trials. We're going to see this in chapters 6 and 7, in chapters 11, 12, and 13, 16 and 17, and then 20. This is a biblical theme also seen throughout the Bible. God's sustaining his people through trial rather than removing them from trial. I want you to hear one scholar. His name's Grant Osborne. He says it this way. I think it's really helpful. He says, quote, "The hour of trial is directed towards the entire non-Christian world, but believers will be kept from it, not by some previous appearance of Christ to remove the church bodily from the world, but by the spiritual protection he provides against it." I want you to look again at verse 10. And this time, I want you to receive this promise for us today, for you and for Faith Church. Here's a striking description of the Christian's reality, that those who keep Jesus's word will be kept by Jesus. This isn't because you keep his word, he will keep you. The accent is not on what they have done. The accent is on what Jesus will do for those who are hanging on to him. It might be by a wee tiny thread that you're hanging on to Jesus. It might be kind of this inconsistent hanging on to Jesus. It might be through kind of a hazy mental fog that you hang on to Jesus and keep his word. But brothers and sisters, know this. He will keep his own. His sheep know his voice. He knows his sheep, and he will preserve them. He will protect them. He will provide for them. So every weak and struggling Christian or church that is kind of characterized by perseverance, not perfection, but growth, that is the kind of Christian and church that Jesus will keep forever. Friends, will you put your confidence in something else or someone else other than Jesus? Listen, friends, there is no other place or thing or person or institution or personal gifting strong enough to bear the weight of your confidence such that you can make it through this life. Your intellectual prowess, your expanding career, your growing bank account, your sparkling personality, your enjoyable relationships, your spiritual works, your successful ministry. You put your confidence in any of these things. You trust any of those things to keep you going, and they will fail you. They are a house of cards. What Jesus alone offers to the ones who keep his word is better than any other place of shelter or security. Here's the fourth reason. Jesus rewards us. He rewards us. If you've been with us for a few weeks, you've seen this pattern in each of the seven letters. It always ends with Jesus promising the particular local church some reward. And what does he promise this church? Notice he loves this church so much. He's so concerned for this church that he gives them kind of the juiciest, the most potent promises that's going to help them to endure. And this morning, I believe he's doing that for you and for me too. And so if you are heavy-hearted, if you're struggling, if you're feeling weak this morning, I want you to put your eyes on this verse, these verses. You know, from verses 7 and 8, we notice Jesus is the key of David, which provides entrance into God's temple kingdom. It's not just the kingdom, it's his temple kingdom. In fact, you'll notice that in verse 12. Look at verse 12 with me. It says, "The one who conquers, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God." And notice a very similar language. "And he will never go out again." You see that? And so first, Christ is promising that we Christians will be these kind of immovable pillars in God's temple someday, which is a striking promise for a city that's beset by earthquakes. Christ is promising us an honored place, a guaranteed place in his temple kingdom. Once we get to the end of Revelation, into chapters 21 and 22, we're going to see that in God's new creation, there will be no temple. Because the whole new creation, the whole new universe will become his temple. And so the language of being a pillar means believers are secure. They will never be removed from the coming new creation. No enemy will ever be able to harm them or remove them from God's presence. The Jews in Philadelphia believe that the true temple is in Jerusalem. Jesus reminds the church that the true temple is the entire new world that is coming. Brothers and sisters, we can often feel left out in this life, left out of friendships, left out of peer groups, left out of office banter. We feel like we're missing out. We're missing out on possessions or sex or success or promotions. But whatever we miss out on, Jesus promises much more in return. We have this incredible future. We have this incredible destiny, and it's secure. The world today can make us an outsider. Jesus has secured for us a place with him where we will never be cast out. And notice there's more than just what we've talked about. Notice that Jesus also promises one day three names will be written on every Christian. You see it? The name of God, the name of the New Jerusalem city, and the name of Jesus himself. And so to have these names means we belong to God and belong to this city and belong to Jesus. We are kind of marked off by God for himself. We are his. And the name of God's city, the New Jerusalem, will be on his people. Do you see that? In other words, we will be members of this heavenly city. The Jewish synagogue prized the earthly city in Jerusalem. But the earthly Jerusalem pointed above and pointed forward to a better Jerusalem, a new Jerusalem, an eschatological Jerusalem, a heavenly Jerusalem. And that's why John would later say, and he says it here too, I saw the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven. Brothers and sisters, our reward is this new city. We belong to it, and it belongs to us. Those who overcome, those who keep his word, will be citizens in this new city. No one can take this away from us. I just find this just such a crazy juxtaposition. You know, you've got this weak church and you've got this triumphant future. This church is so weak in the world's eyes, in Philadelphia's eyes. These Christians, no one cares who they are. They're powerless. They're easy to ignore. They're outsiders. They should be made to feel uncomfortable. But they belong to God. And they belong to his son. And they belong to the city of God. If you consider our life in kind of this long, never-ending rope of eternity, right? Our 70, 80, 90 years, just kind of a little blip, a snap of the finger, a dot on that line. Eternity stretches out far into the future such that it's just really hard for us to fathom. And so what does it really matter, friends, what the world thinks about us? What does it matter how this fallen world interferes with us? When Jesus has secured for us such a vast gift that stretches out far into eternity, a gift that encompasses our great God and his beloved Son and the people of God in the city of God forever and ever and ever. You know, this morning, I just want us to feel the utter avalanche of blessings and love that Jesus pours out on all who keep his word. If you feel weak, look at who Jesus is for you. If you feel powerless and limited and hindered, look at what Jesus offers you now, but also millennia into the future. It's something I heard recently Kevin DeYoung talk about. You don't have to live the way the world tells you to live. You don't have to do that. You can drop your confidence in the world. You can renew your confidence in Christ this morning. Because there's no one more committed to you than Jesus. There's no one who is spending spiritual resources and power and love and mercy and grace, everything you need. It's all hidden. You know, you can't see all of that stuff, but it's coming at you every day. And only those with eyes to see can see it. Of course, there are scary things in this world. Of course, there are many reasons to be discouraged about our country, about our culture. But listen, friends, you and I are part of the one single institution on earth that cannot fail, and that's the church. Because the God of the universe and his beloved Son, his exalted Son, are fiercely committed to the church and committed to you, are part of the church. And so wave after wave of commitment, right, and care and blessing to you and to Faith Church and to the global church, the universal church, we see it here. Evangelism still works, brothers and sisters. Our prayers are still heard and answered. Churches are still getting planted. Pastors and Christians are still being equipped for ministry. Scriptures are still being translated. Missionary teams are still being sent out. People are still being saved. God's church is still being added to every month and every year, all because Jesus is still mighty to save. He is mighty to save. And that doesn't mean the first time when you were converted, and maybe that was 20 years ago, maybe that was 3 years ago. That means he's going to get you through all the way. Jesus will keep you. He will keep you because you are the sort of person who will keep his word. Praise God. Amen. Let's take a moment now to prepare our hearts for the Lord's Supper and to ponder the passage.